from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Flannery O'Connor shares the big screen with some of her most memorable short story characters in the new indie film Wildcat. O'Connor scholar Jessica Houghton Wilson gives her take on the film and what animates the Catholic 20th century writer's prophetic imagination. Then we turn to discuss the implications of the Biden administration's new interpretation of Title IX, which redefines sex discrimination to include a student's self-asserted gender identity. Franciscan University of Steubenville's president, Father David Pravanka, joins us to explain why Franciscan University has pushed back against the rule. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, and I'm your host here on Register Radio. Wildcat is a film that was released in select theaters on May 3rd. It's a biopic on a period of Flannery O'Connor's life when she was working to become a great writer but was challenged in her plans by a lupus diagnosis. The film was directed and co-written by Ethan Hawke, and his daughter, actress Maya Hawke, plays Flannery. The film shows how Flannery O'Connor's work was animated by her Catholic faith, and also how her writing in the Southern Gothic style examined questions of faith, morality, and suffering. Our guest today is Jessica Houghton Wilson, who has studied O'Connor's life and writings. She is the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in California, and she's taught at the University of Dallas. She's published 8 books, and her most recent one, published this year, is Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. Jessica, I am so grateful to have you on the show with us today.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
So, I watched the film. I enjoyed it myself, and I know that you did too. You wrote a column at Christianity Today with the headline, Wildcat is as unsettling as Flannery O'Connor would have wanted it. an interesting analysis, and you talk about how the film was about as scandalous as some of her short stories. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I found in the film is it didn't just portray realism on the surface, so it didn't follow through her life in a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. Instead, it was focused on the art. I think the way that Flannery herself put her art before anything in her life, even famously when she went to Lourdes to heal her bones from lupus, she said, I prayed for my book, not for my bones. Mm-hmm. And I think that the film does that as well. I think it is constantly putting her art at the forefront, the way that it integrates with her life and the way that it looks at the style. It's kind of experimental. It's focusing on the freakishness, on things that are kind of not distasteful to the palate, but maybe a little unsettling.
Right. Jarring. Yeah. So many
jarring,
times
it's
jarring. So the movie itself, it's about her. And as I said, Maya Hawke plays her, and it at times though, it kind of, suddenly you find yourself watching a part of one of her short stories. But it's the same characters, right? So Maya Hawke will play another character. And it can be a little bit confusing, and some people have described that as a drawback to the film. Mm-hmm. But I think that is a part of the her nature, too, was to kind of jar you. Why did O'Connor do that? What was her... what was her point in that kind of jarring and unsettling way? In fact, I mean, she prays about this. Help me get down under things where you are, right? Why?
Right. For Flannery, she was always wanting to get at the eternal things that were happening. She was looking metaphysically, or some people have described her work as sacramental. So what are the things happening on the metaphysical plane when what we see and experience has to do with our 5 senses? So her work was always trying to get down under that. And in order to do so, a lot of times she was asking her readers to pay closer attention, to see things like a sun and not just see the sun as we empirically know it or the sunshine, but kind of see it with like a medieval eye, with an eye towards enchantment. The sun is also our sign in the east, a reminder of hope, our drawing heavenward, our eyes. And so I think this film is trying to do the same kind of thing. It's trying to get readers to look closely to pay attention in the same way that when you read a Flannery O'Connor story, after you finish, you have to go back and read it again to read it well. This is the kind of film that demands you watch it once and then you want to watch it again because you really want to pay attention to what was happening.
Absolutely, I agree. And I only watched it once. And then after reading some reviews and some reading your work, I wanted to go see it again. And I probably will, because I agree with you. I think it needs that extra reflection. But it certainly does start to make you think. And I remember the first time I read Flannery O'Connor. I was in college. It was a summer. I was away from home. I was lonely. I got the book from the library. I think it was A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And I just remember being pierced by it. And my experience of it was that it was about piercing love, like that that Christ could pierce us with his love. And so I very quickly and easily got her mystical sense and became, you know, just loved her work and still enjoy picking even the ones I've read before over and over again. Not everybody feels that way. Is there a key for people to understand Flannery?
I think the key has to do with what you were talking about with being pierced by her work. I think that she is wanting people to have a different imagination about pain and suffering. And when we think in terms of our immortal life rather than the here and now, which is often focused on our pleasure and on our happiness, but we think more in terms of being refined. You know, T.S. Eliot talks about being refined by fire. I think that's what Flannery O'Connor's work was trying to do. And so if we can come around to the idea that this fiction is in some ways purifying us or the pain has a purpose, and she's not trying to torture us, she's trying to help us have a paradigm shift. She's trying to move us towards a greater understanding. And that whole process, you know, learning is painful. The greatest things you learn a lot of times force us to be uncomfortable and to change. And I think that that's what she's aiming at.
Right. And this movie really helps you to see that experience of pain and suffering in her own life. I mean, she had great ambitions. And she was, you know, hoping to be in New York as a writer. She, was able to study and tutor under some of the best at that time frame and really had high hopes. And this lupus diagnosis is what brought her back to Georgia, living under her mom's roof, around people who really didn't understand her art or what she wanted to accomplish. Now, if she was in New York, she would be around a lot of people who didn't understand her faith either, and it shows that. So suffering was a key in her own life, right?
Yes, absolutely. I thought the film did that incredibly well, especially how they overlaid the prayers. While you're seeing her story and you're getting to hear the things that she's praying, because she herself prayed, Lord, grant me the grace to be able to handle the suffering.
Absolutely. And there's a really compelling scene where her diagnosis, her lupus is really bad, and it's prohibiting her from kind of living the way she wanted to live. And she's talking to a priest, and you see her vulnerable. And really, in the rest of the film, you don't see her so vulnerable. You see her because she had a great wit. She was sharp, a little jagged. but you see her vulnerability, and it's really, really beautiful. I could talk on and on. I could pick your brain about Flannery O'Connor for hours. But I really want to get to the book that you have just published. This is Why Do the Heathens Rage? Is part of the title. I know it's got a subtitle. But it's really, that was her novel that was unfinished when she died in 1964 at the age of 39. It was unpublished until now. And you've taken this up in your latest book. What does it contain?
So this is really, it's a collection of the fragments that she left behind. But what I tried to do is to put it in the story of her life. So there's some parallel in a sense with the film, trying to integrate her life with her fiction. And I'm doing something similar with her unfinished work. You know, what was she reading between 1960 and 1964? What was happening in the headlines? What was happening in her world? So that we can kind of fill in the gap with her biography for, you know, what she might have intended and what she was wanting to do and where her desires were at the end of her life. And also the promise. What could we have seen from Flannery O'Connor that we didn't get because lupus took her too soon? And instead, kind of imagining and wondering those things from the fragments of her third novel that she gives us.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I mean, it's fascinating that you can piece that together. And so yes, I'm going to repeat that title so people can look for it. Why Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A Behind the Scenes Look at a Work in Progress by Jessica Hooten Wilson. And Jessica, I'm so grateful that you were able to come on today and to share your thoughts. I invite people to read your reflection on this movie, Wildcats, at Christianity Today. And also to check out your podcast, which is The Scandal of Reading, Pursuing Holy Wisdom with Christ and Pop Culture. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Jeanette.
When we come back, we talk to Franciscan University of Steubenville President Father David Pivanka about resisting the Biden administration's gender ideology push. This is Register Radio on EWTN. Stay tuned.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, and I'm your host here on Register Radio. I'm joined by Father Dave Pivanka. He is the president of Franciscan University of Steubenville, a position he's held since 2019, and he's a member of the Franciscan Friars of the Third Order Regular at the Providence of Most Sacred Heart of Jesus. He was ordained a priest in 1996, and Father Dave and I are alumni of Franciscan University, and I'm quite proud of his leadership there and very grateful to have him here today. So, Father Dave, welcome.
It's my pleasure, and I'm quite proud of all you're doing as well, so this is going to be great.
Thanks so much. So, let's see. Well, lots of news, lots of university news in the headlines these days.
Yeah.
And I think one that directly touches upon Franciscan University and really a lot of colleges should be concerned about this is President Joe Biden's, his Department of Education has issued new regulations on April 19th. That prohibit discrimination based on a person's gender identity. So these new rules, which go into effect basically right in time for the next school year, redefine the prohibition on sex discrimination for schools and any educational program that receives federal funding. So that's K through 12 schools, colleges and universities, and basically this is that any kind of any discrimination against on a person's self-reported gender identity is ruled out. You can't do that. So, Father Dave, what would this mean? I realize Franciscan has an exemption. We'll talk about that in a second. But what does this mean? How would it impact schools in general? Following these rules, what would that mean?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the big change is this, the idea that one's self-identification can then now, you know, forever dictate one's sex. And because of that, institutions are going to have to make accommodations for those individuals. So where it plays itself out most, honestly, is in residence halls.
Right.
That if a biological male identifies as a woman, then that individual has the right now to be in a woman's dormitory, women's bathrooms, women's locker rooms, women's athletic teams. And, you know, I had actually written a piece that USA Today picked up on about a year and a half ago, actually maybe 2 years ago now. And the title of it was The Body Matters, you know, and while I didn't come out and just quote John Paul, but it was very much saying the human body matters and we can't be dismissive of biology and the human person. And in essence, what he's saying is, that really doesn't matter. Just however any individual identifies themselves, and that's ultimately trumps everything else.
Right.
And you're right that that we do have a religious exemption, but I still felt the need to come out and say that this just isn't right. It as a Catholic institution, we're not going to abide by it. And yeah, the feedback has been what you would expect.
Which is, I'm sure, from some support and from others, concern. And I think it's important to speak to the university's efforts, though, to understand where some people are. and to understand where this comes from in our society. So for people who are experiencing this this gender identity, calling themselves the opposite, you know, what their not what their body reflects, but what they feel they are. How do we respond to those people who are experiencing this gender dysphoria?
Yeah, and honestly, I think we at the university have done a really good job. Now, there's always going to be people that say, unless you do what they want or what the other side wants, you're not doing a good job. But we have a program at the university called Integratus. And when it's started by the students, and it's largely led by the students. And when they came to me and approached me about this, they made it clear, and then I wanted to affirm that this is not, quote unquote, a support group. It's a faith group. And it's groups of individual students who struggle with some of these questions. And some of them struggle personally, and then some of them struggle with the teachings of the church. But they want to be able to be faithful to the church. They want to understand what the church is saying. You know, there's a growing segment out in culture today that says, by the very nature, the church's teachings are abusive. And that's just fundamentally flawed, that the church's teaching always speaks to the beauty of human sexuality, the beauty and dignity of the human person. Just because you might not agree with that doesn't mean that it's, in fact, abusive. So I'm really proud of the way our students are handling this. The university's got a compendium on human sexuality that every couple of years we take a look at it and make sure that it's consistent today with what the church is saying, but then also has a pastoral sensitivity and care for the population of individuals that are struggling. And the reality is, just because you have faith doesn't mean that some of our young people aren't struggling with these questions, because they are. And we want to be able to walk with them in the light of faith and help to lead them, again, to the beauty of what the church is saying about sexuality.
Absolutely. Our eyes are not blinded to these experiences and to these sometimes struggles, deep struggles, to the loneliness, to all of that. So I think it's very important for us to always state that, even if we are resisting what is being pushed on us and really unjustly so. And I think that's why, Franciscan University sought an exemption, right? I think you had to seek that. Yes. But you're also speaking out about it and want to help reflect and change public policy, because you believe it's unjust, this what is happening. So did you have to seek an exemption? What you sort of saw the writing on the wall. So how are you exempt?
Right. Over the years, we've had some multiple exemptions and received those. And right now, thank the Lord, we've got courts that are largely very supportive of religious freedom and religious exemptions that ought to be given to us because of our faith. But I still think, as you stated, I still think it's fundamentally flawed. So that this is not merely, in my mind, it's not merely a religious issue. I think it's basically a human issue. And that's why, and I think you were going to mention earlier, we've got a conference coming up in the fall where we're having this conversation. I mean, it's hard to believe and imagine that today we're questioning, what does it mean to be human? And we've seen that in the pro-life cause. I mean, there's a population that would say that a baby's not human, but what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be male and female? Why did God create us different? Why is there a unique beauty and dignity in the human person as male and the human person as female? And these are questions that are not merely faith questions. They have a huge ramifications on culture and on what the identity of person and relationships and structures and families and all these kinds of really, really important topics. So we're going to be doing a conference this summer, just really talking with this and shedding light into these fundamental questions that are being asked in our culture today. From a faith perspective, but also just from merely a biological question.
Right. And all of this has so much to do also with our happiness, right? Our happiness here and our happiness in eternity. So huge questions, important questions. So I'm talking to Father David Pavanka, the president of Franciscan University of Steubenville. And right now we're actually talking about a conference that's taking place October 24th through 26th in 2024. It's called Man, Woman, and the Order of Creation. And this will deal with some of the the pressures that we face today, especially this pressure towards transgender or gender ideology. And Pope Francis has spoken out about this and in a recent document where he says this isn't right. This isn't good. This isn't the true identity of the human person. And so this is an attempt to understand that and to spread that. Who are some of the people that will be there, Father?
Yeah, Deborah Savage will be a part of it. Mary Hassan will be a part of it. I think Abigail Sabali is going to be a part of it.
Dr. Greg Bataro.
Bataro is going to be a part of it, right?
Right. Aaron Cariotti. These are a lot of people who have studied these issues, and I think can give some really great insights. I'm loving the conferences and these important questions that the university is taking up. I think there's another important question that you took up in a conference and with other public square statements in the fall, and that related to the Hamas and Israel war. You had a conference on anti-Semitism, and you also made an invitation to students, Jewish students who might be experiencing hostilities on their own campus. Did you have people who took you up on that? Explain a little more about that last
year. Yeah. Well, it was very personal for me too. When on October, I believe it was the ninth, perhaps, when Hamas attacked Israel, we actually had 31 Francis University students in Israel in the Holy Land at the time. And as a president, had a great concern for their safety. Thank the Lord, we were able to get them out safely. But when I was watching what was going on campuses across the United States, to be a college student and not to feel safe on your own campus just seemed inconsistent with me. So what we did is we made a simple offer. We said, if you don't feel safe in your campus, we'll have an expedite transfer portal that allow you to come here. Long story short is we did not have any students take it up as of yet, but we do have a student who's going to come in the fall and get a graduate degree with it. Interesting thing that's come about from this, though, Jeanette, is we've actually had faculty reach out to us and say, you know, the Jewish faculty that say that they don't feel comfortable at the university that they're at. They also don't feel comfortable teaching some of the things that they've been teaching for decades because of the tenor of higher education in some of these places, institutions right now. So we've gotten a lot of feedback from it. And my hope, honestly, was that other schools would adopt this same invitation. That didn't quite go as I had hoped, but that's okay. We did what we felt we were supposed to do.
Right. And so as you're looking at other colleges, college campuses, university campuses, and the stress and the tension they have experienced now for a month intensely, where these protests have kind of taken over, I mean, encampments, they are really, in a way, halting normal activity on school campuses, and have had to be cleared away by police, and it's really reached a climax, right?
It's been interesting. Yeah, it's interesting living with friars of different ages. It's really one of the great blessings of being in a religious life. And some of the old friars are like, this is the 60s revisited, you know, these same images. But it's a lack of respect for decency of the institution, of their classmates. I mean, it's so disruptive to what's going on. But it's also, I think, in many ways, I don't want to say that it's ignorant. I think it's misguided. It's misguided on how they're going about it. And ultimately, I think it's a cause without a real passion. I think it's just something that a large population of the young people are just getting drawn into it, really don't understand what they're doing.
Yeah. Sometimes it seems like misplaced compassion. I mean, I think we should be extremely concerned about the Palestinians. However, sure. Sometimes that compassion can be misplaced. And I think you're right. It's super complex. But it's definitely something that I think has shocked us all and brought back, you know, I'm trying to understand it. I didn't live through the 60s. I'm trying to understand what does this actually do? So it's really been a stretch for us to really understand this. While we have just a couple minutes. Oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, just that's the thing that they're discovering too, is there's a lot of people that are involved in these that are actually aren't even students.
Right.
So it's become,
activists.
It's a show. It's unfortunate.
It's activism.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to end on that note. I want to end on this note. May 10th and 11th, commencement exercises begin for Franciscan University. It's the largest graduating class for the fourth year in a row. You've had the largest graduating class, 896 students. That's absolutely amazing.
It's so great.
What a wonderful, what's happening?
We're so excited. It's just, you know, honestly, Jeanette, in some ways, the things that are going on in culture, families and young people are saying, I just don't want to be a part of that. And they realize that they can come to a place like Franciscan University where they're going to get an outstanding education. They're going to be formed and prepared for whatever career they go. And they're also going to be formed in their faith. And it's just a really exciting time to be at the university. And I think you're aware that Justice Alito will be receiving an honorary degree and speaking to the students. And I mean, they're just so thrilled on every aspect of being able to have Alito with us. It will be a great blessing.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for being with us today. Congratulations for that wonderful class of 2024. And
we will stay
in touch. So remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. Together with Matthew Bunsen and my producer, Michael McCall, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, I pray God bless you.